footsteps. Jack stepped forward as softly as possible, right onto a squeaking board. Shit! Jack froze, listened. Nothing. Wait. In the distance, a sound, muffled. Music. Singing? He wasn't sure. Not in the house. Where? The shed, maybe. If so, it must have been loud as hell for him to hear it all the way in here. A loose floorboard creaked on the other side of the swinging door. Jack cocked his head, listening. Suddenly, heavy footfalls stomped and crashed. Aida was running away. Jack charged for the kitchen. Three gunshots blasted through the door as he reached it, forcing him back. He counted three, then kicked the door open. He charged in, gun up, ready to fire. Nobody there. Just an old farm table with a few stacks of bundled euros on it, left behind in a rush. Feet thundered down a flight of stairs on his right, an open door leading to a stairwell. He dashed to the open door, stopped. Cool, musty air rose up from the dank basement below. He ducked his head around the corner, pulled it back. Three more shots rang out from the bottom of the stairs. Jack felt the overpressure brush against his face like an invisible hand. The rounds crashed into the wall to his left. He reached his hand around the corner and fired off three shots down into the dark, expecting to hit nothing. He didn't, but they did the job. Reconnaissance by fire. Nobody fired back. Five shots left in his eight-shot magazine. He dropped down low and took another quick look. Nothing. Not even a sound. He held his pistol in front of him as he descended, pointing down toward the bottom of the stairs. The musty smell grew. The stairs were still lit by the light from behind him. He was a backlit target here. Jack moved quickly, sighting his weapon into the muddy black of the rest of the basement where Aida was. He wished he had night vision goggles or a high-powered tactical flashlight. He reached the bottom of the stairs, the foundation wall just a few feet in front of him. He could barely make out another wall on his right, 6 feet away. He dashed over to it. No, not a wall, exactly. More like shelving. In the dim light, he saw cases of American MREs, folded Bundeswehr camouflage uniforms, canned food, bottled water. Jack felt his way along the shelf wall, listening intently. He heard nothing but the far distant music, and felt a faint, cool breath of earthy air brushing against his skin. He reached the end of the shelving wall and found a doorway. He knelt down. Aida was on the other side, her pistol pointed at the opening, ready to blow his head off. From his crouching position, he reached his pistol around the corner and fired his last five shots, emptying the mag. His ears ached from the explosions, stabbing his unprotected eardrums like ice picks. The slide of the empty pistol locked open. Jack pulled the weapon back around, dropped the empty mag, slammed home his last full one and racked the slide shut, chambering around in just under 2 seconds. He'd done it enough times in training with his eyes closed and Clark firing a pistol next to his face that it was as natural a movement as breathing. He listened again through his ringing ears. Nothing. She was either dead or one cool customer. He didn't really care which. Alive was good, because she would have valuable intel. But dead would feel a hell of a lot better. Jack turned the corner with his weapon up, ready to shoot. She was gone. Chapter 66. Aida was gone, all right. Right down the damn hole in the ground. A square steel trap door lay open. The cool air that brushed against him earlier was now almost a breeze. It smelled like wet dirt and wood. A tunnel, lit from down below. There was a wooden ladder, but Jack skipped it and made the 5.5-foot drop, his gun at high ready. He thumped onto the hard-packed dirt, his boots nearly stepping on another packet of money that must have fallen out of whatever Aida was lugging around. He crouched to avoid the low timber ceiling and the naked bulb hanging by a wire just above his head. The walls were lumber, too. It reminded him of the Tunnel of Hope near the airport that Aida had shown him before. He was glad for the light bulb over his head. He hated the idea of running down here in the dark, Three shots rang out from the black void ahead. Wood splintered by Jack's head. He swore bitterly. Idiot! The damn light only made him an easy target. He smashed the bulb with his pistol before leaping for the dirt. He heard dull footfalls far up ahead. Jack jumped to his feet and charged forward, still crouching to keep from knocking himself out on the timbered ceiling. There was no more light in the tunnel, and the crunching glass beneath his feet told him that Aida had been smashing bulbs as she ran. He'd haloed out of airplanes on moonless nights without batting an eye, but somehow running down here was a lot more frightening. He couldn't shake the feeling he was about to slam face first into something running full speed in the dark. He must have covered 200 feet in his low crouching run before Aida's pistol roared and flashed at the dark end of the tunnel, its sharp retort muffled by the wood and dirt. Splintering timber cracked nearby and Jack dropped to the ground again, firing 3 shots back in the direction of the flashes. 5 shots left. He heard Aida curse in the distance and the sound of feet shuffling through the dirt. Jack listened again and aimed his pistol in the direction of the sound. He fired 3 more rounds. Only 2 left now. But his last 3 shots had lit up the tunnel near where he was lying. He caught sight of a small alcove just a few feet up ahead on his right. A storage area, he guessed. He belly crawled as fast as he could to the alcove and rolled into it, bumping into what felt like more wood shelving. His ringing ears quieted enough that he could hear the music more clearly now, still muffled at the far end of the tunnel. Melodic male voices were singing a cappella in... what, Arabic? He couldn't be sure. The voices were joyous, upbeat, powerful. What did they call that kind of music? Nasheed, Jack remembered. Islamic hymns. The kind of stuff that jihadis sang before going into battle. It wasn't so loud that he couldn't hear Aida swearing and tramping ahead, though. Where was she going? She was running toward the music. Jack rolled out of the alcove again and stayed on his belly, aiming his pistol forward with muscle memory, since he couldn't actually see anything. It was so dark he couldn't be sure his eyes were actually open except by blinking. He was hoping Aida would fire at him again and he could use her flash as a target now that he was ready for it. But none was coming. If she reached that other trap door, she might get help. Or worse. He couldn't let her do that. He had to assume that the miners would dig the tunnel as straight as possible to avoid wasting their energy, and if there was another trap door on the other side of the tunnel, that's what Aida would be moving toward, and that door would be straight ahead too. All he had to do was to aim straight down the center of the tunnel, halfway between the floor and the ceiling. 2 shots of .45 caliber lead in the square of her back would put her down easily, drop her before she could reach the ladder. Jack sighted the pistol in the blinding dark, hoping he was aiming dead center. He started to squeeze the trigger. He stopped. Aida would know that his only hope of hitting her in the dark would be to shoot dead center. Jack angled his pistol left, toward what he imagined was the far left corner, and fired twice. He pointed right and fired again. His pistol locked open after just 1 shot. Out of ammo. He listened. All he could hear was the muffled music and gurgling. He dropped his empty weapon, jumped up, and scurried forward in a low crouch, weaving just a little in case she was aiming in the dark, too. But in the cramped space, he had little hope of dodging anything like a bullet, especially as he got closer to the sound. He reached for his phone just as he heard feet kicking hard in the dirt in front of him. He dove for the ground. The kicking and gurgling sounds suddenly stopped. Jack held his breath. He listened again in the smothering dark. Only the distant, muted music. He crawled forward on his elbows until his left hand hit something and he recoiled, freezing in place. He listened again. Nothing. He reached his left hand out, felt around, touched hard rubber. He flinched back, waited, reached out again. It was the sole of a shoe. He pulled up his phone and touched the flashlight feature. His eyes ached from the bright light. He shined it at the shoe. It was Aida's foot, all right, attached to her corpse. A half-open duffel lay by her side, along with several stacks of cash scattered on the dirt floor. He moved closer. Her body lay against the left tunnel wall, her throat torn open by a 45 caliber slug, which practically decapitated her. The bulb in the phone formed catchlights in her lifeless blue eyes. He checked the time on his iWatch. It was 10:08 a.m. 7 minutes to launch. At 10:08 a.m. local time, the first Tomahawk arrived at its last GPS waypoint, 5 miles due west of the Sarajevo airport terminal. It slowed its speed by half. This latest cruise missile variant was capable of loitering over a battlefield like a regular aircraft, and able to retarget via its two-way satellite control and GPS targeting systems. Not having the luxuries of either knowing the target location in advance or having the time to wait to launch, President Ryan decided to put 2 Tomahawks in loitering mode over an unpopulated area near Sarajevo. He hoped to God that Jack and the rest of the campus could locate the BM-21 Grad launcher before 10:15 local. In the event the target couldn't be acquired, the Tomahawks would be redirected back out to the Adriatic Sea and their explosive payloads detonated harmlessly. Croatian and Bosnian air traffic control were notified about the Tomahawks' unannounced training mission and their flight paths just before launch, as were their respective governments. Ryan believed it was always better to ask forgiveness than permission, especially in a crisis situation. Given the flight time to and from the final waypoint, it was estimated each Tomahawk had approximately 72 minutes of loitering time. Far more time than was left. Chapter 67. He fished around in Aida's pockets and found her cell phone and took it, then snagged up her pistol to replace his own. His boots squished in the oozing gore near her head in the narrow passage as he sprinted away in a crouch to the other end of the tunnel. 100 feet before he reached the ladder, he heard Gavin's desperate voice crackling in his Bluetooth. "Jack, I reached, can't, signal, launcher." "Say again." Jack was near the ladder now. "I can't find the drone signal. I don't know where the launcher is." "I might." "Where?" "How much time before launch?" "Just under 7 minutes. We have 2 Tomahawks on station ready to go. We just don't have a target." "Tomahawks can use GPS coordinates for targeting, right?" "Sure, why?" "Can you link my phone GPS to the Tomahawks?" "Huh, maybe. I don't see why not. It will take a few minutes." "We don't have a few minutes. I'll call you when they're linked." Jack stood at the ladder nearly breathless. The metal trap door was shut. He climbed up the 5.5 feet and stood at the top of the ladder and listened for a moment. The muffled jihadi nasheed music he had heard earlier now thundered above the steel plate. He pushed gently on the trap door, just enough to get a view. The music roared in his ears now. Big truck tires were in front of him, and beyond them the steel walls of a metal building erected on a slab of reinforced concrete. The shed's front and rear doors were slid open. He also saw a spool of cable. At the end of the cable, hanging down from the side of the truck for easy access, was a box with covered safety switches. "A manual launch trigger?" Jack wondered. Jack checked his watch. 6 minutes to go. He looked to his right and saw a big man in camouflage standing outside the building entrance, his broad back to Jack. He was holding an electronic device in his hands, supported by a shoulder rig, his head bouncing to the nasheed. Jack glanced up at the 40-box rocket launcher on the back of the truck, angled ominously toward the sky. Above the launcher, the camouflage netting that served as the roof was rolling back. Jack shifted his gaze. He saw a smaller man in a camouflage uniform standing in the far corner, turning a hand crank. "Jerry, are you there?" Jack whispered. "Yes, Jack. Go ahead." "I see the truck." Gavin crackled on his earpiece. "Jack, the Tomahawk is now targeted on your phone GPS." "Jack," the president said, "leave your phone there and get the hell out. That Tomahawk will be there in 90 seconds. Clear as far away as you can." "Roger that. Bullets suddenly spanged against the metal trapdoor and slammed into the floor, stinging Jack's skin with jagged shards of concrete. Jack flung the trapdoor wide open as he aimed Aida's pistol at the man in the corner, firing off two rounds even before he drew a bead. The first shot punched the man in the gut, the second through the heart. He thudded onto the floor on the far side of the truck, cracking his skull, but he was already dead. Jack scrambled out of the hole and toward the big man up front, who was lunging for a rifle propped against the wall near him. Jack aimed his pistol at the man's head and pulled the trigger. Misfire. He racked another round. The gun locked open. The misfire was the last cartridge. Empty. Jack swore and sprinted hard at the larger man, swinging the pistol in his hand like a hammer at the man's skull. But the big Chechen lieutenant raised his rifle with two hands like a blocking guard and blunted Jack's blow. A stinger of pain shot up Jack's arms and his useless pistol clattered to the concrete. The nasheed roared in Jack's ears. He could barely hear his dad's voice shouting, "Jack, get out of there now!" Jack grabbed the Chechen's rifle with both hands, pumping his legs as hard as he could to drive the bigger man hard against the steel wall. The Chechen laughed, flashing wide teeth beneath his hairless upper lip. He thrust his massive skull like a cannonball at Jack's face. Jack whipped his head to one side, avoiding the head strike, then whipped his head back to crack against the side of the Chechen's face. But Jack's strike was too weak and did nothing except shoot a bolt of pain through his own skull. As if on cue, they both launched a series of hard, nasty kicks against each other, still wrestling with the gun between them. Jack's shins screamed with pain with every blow he got and every one he gave. Jack twisted his arms right to throw the bigger man off balance, but he barely budged. The Chechen countered by thrusting the butt of the gun with his left hand toward Jack's gut. Jack countered him by pulling the butt hard toward him, using the man's own strength and momentum against him. Jack twisted sideways as he pulled, finally throwing the larger man off balance and toward the hard floor. As the Chechen fell, he fought his instinct to catch himself with his hands, and instead held on to the rifle for dear life. His greater weight pulled Jack down with him, and the two hit the concrete at the same time. The Chechen crashed onto his back, and Jack fell on top of him, still clutching the rifle, as the music screamed in their ears. Jack thrust a knee into the Chechen's groin. Zhabrailov grunted in agony, but still managed to twist the rifle hard enough to pop Jack in the jaw with the stock. The sharp crack of pain loosened Jack's grip for a second, but not enough to give way. Exhausted, both men kept trying to use the gun as a bludgeon against each other while throwing knees and headbutts, but the strikes were weaker and weaker. After another failed swipe, the bigger, stronger Chechen changed tactics and began pushing with his legs and rolling his shoulders to drag Jack slowly back toward the manual launcher, just a few feet away. "Jack, 60 seconds! Run!" his father shouted. Over the din of the nasheed music, Jack felt more than heard the thundering beat of helicopter blades in the air. So did Zhabrailov. The Chechen kicked and rolled harder, inching inexorably closer to the manual launcher. Jack tried to drag his boots against the concrete and pull back with his arms, but the larger man was too strong. He had to change gears. Jack lunged to his feet to try to use his legs to leverage the rifle out of the man's powerful hands. Jack couldn't stand up straight, and in his low crouch, he was off balance. The wily Chechen took advantage of it. He shoved his boot into Jack's gut and lifted him up with it as he pulled the rifle down to his broad chest with a berserker shout, levering Jack up in the air and over the Chechen's head in a classic judo tomoya nage. Jack held onto the rifle, crashing hard on his back on the concrete, which knocked his breath out, stunning him. The Chechen had the tactical advantage now. He let go of the rifle, rolled over, and leaped to his feet. The Chechen's left foot stomped on the rifle, crushing Jack's knuckles against the floor. Zhabrailov planted his heavy right boot square into Jack's chest to launch himself over Jack. He stretched out his long arms to grab the launcher dangling just beyond Jack's boots. Jack saw what he was doing and snagged the man's foot and ankle with his aching hands. The Chechen fell hard and short of the launcher, crashing between Jack's legs, screaming with rage. The rifle was just inches from Jack's face, but he had to let go of the Chechen to get it, and if he did, the jihadi would squirm forward the few inches he needed to hit the launcher before he could shoot him. Jack, 30 seconds! If he let go now, he could make a run for it and save his neck. But then all of those people would die. If he held on, the tomahawk would take care of everything, and it would cost him his life. He knew what he had to do. Jack tightened his grip, straining every muscle to hold the Chechen back, the man's legs kicking furiously against Jack's desperate grip. Dust and air pummeled Jack as the black EC-635 Eurocopter touched down, its whining turbines hardly slowing. Jack twisted around just enough to catch a glimpse of Kolak racing from the chopper toward him, a pistol in his hand. A pistol pointed at Jack. Chapter 68. Olympic Soccer Stadium, Sarajevo, Bosnia and Herzegovina. Ambassador Topal was given the honor of sitting on the raised dais next to the Catholic Bishop of Sarajevo and other distinguished guests of the Orthodox Renewal Liturgy. The officiating senior clergy wore fantastical silken white robes, hand-embroidered with silver thread, and large jewel-encrusted hats shaped like crowns. Their large crosses of silver and gold hung around their necks on thick chains, and they carried ecclesiastical instruments in their liver-spotted hands. The neatness of their finely gilded vestments was offset by the wild enormity of their scraggly gray beards. The clean-shaven Roman Catholic bishop seated next to him, in contrast, wore a simple black cassock with a bright red sash and a matching red skullcap. Not that the Catholics couldn't be every bit as colorful in their garish robes and golden accoutrements, but today at the Renewal, they avoided competing sartorially with their Eastern brethren. The only real difference between senior Roman Catholic and Orthodox clergy that Topal had ever observed was that Catholics shaved their faces. As far as he was concerned, their doctrinal differences were irrelevant, because their religions were kafir. As one of just three Muslims in the distinguished guests box, Ambassador Topal felt a particular gratitude for his invitation. He knew quite a few of the local Orthodox clergy, and most of the Russian and Serbian politicians in attendance. The mood so far was both festive and solemn. Crowds of faithful were still streaming into the stadium, waving nationalist flags and religious banners, packing in like sardines. His security chief informed him the official count was now just above 70,000 and rising, the largest stadium audience ever. Topal nodded, satisfied. He was proud to be part of this historic day. A day to be remembered. Jack felt the rapid-fire bullets brushing past the top of his skull. The Chechen's back ripped open in a hail of jacketed rounds and his heavy torso slumped. Kolak grabbed Jack by the arms, lifting him to his feet. "Jack, let's go!" The two men sprinted for the chopper at full tilt. 15 seconds, the president screamed in Jack's ear. The rotors sped up and the skids lifted as Kolak leaped first into the cabin. Jack thundered up as the Eurocopter rose to 4 feet. He jumped with every ounce of his failing strength. His upper body thudded into the deck as he reached for the seat struts bolted onto the floor, but his legs were still hanging out. The copter thrust straight up and around. The centrifugal force started dragging him out the door, but Kolak grabbed Jack's shirt and belt, helping Jack crawl inside as the chopper's nose thrust upward, clawing for the sun. "Everybody strap in!" the pilot shouted. Jack and Kolak fell into their seats, literally, and buckled up. Jack knew they needed to clear the area before those warheads. A blinding white light erupted beneath the climbing Eurocopter, screaming for altitude. But they weren't high enough. The thermobaric munitions burned away the oxygen in the surrounding atmosphere, creating an enormous vacuum, robbing the rotors of their lift capability. The chopper bucked and yawed as the pilot fought for control in the turbulence. Just as she stabilized, a concussive wave slapped the thin-skinned aircraft hard, hurling it toward the ground. Chapter 69. Washington, D.C. The president sighed with relief as the applause and cheers rang out from the VTC monitors in the Situation Room. "And still over 4 minutes to spare," Arnie said, smiling. "Not bad." The second Tomahawk was still providing a live video feed of the thermobaric explosion. The entire compound was leveled, and whatever wasn't destroyed was burning. "We have a problem, Mr. President," the Russian president said. Ryan's relief disappeared. "What problem?" "My intelligence chief just reviewed the Tomahawk video feed. It cannot be determined with certainty, but it appears that there were 40 rockets on the launcher." "Yes, that is correct. Why is that a problem?" "It is a problem because 80 thermobaric rockets were stolen." President Ryan turned to his chief of staff, whose shocked face mirrored his own. "Where the hell were those other missiles?" "Jack, this is your dad. Come in, please." No answer. "Jack. Jack!" "He's not responding, sir," the comms tech said. "Keep trying, please," Ryan said.
"Mr. President, what do you suggest?" the Russian president asked again.
"One moment, please," Ryan said. He put the Russian on mute, the only person on the VTC who wasn't part of his inner circle. "Any thoughts, people?" "Another launcher?" Admiral Dean offered. "Maybe," Ryan said, "but we have no indication of that." "Or we just missed the other 40 missiles. Maybe they were stacked in that building where we couldn't see them," Arnie said. "Or maybe they're being saved for a future operation," Foley suggested. "No. Whoever planned this attack only had one launcher, and they had one giant opportunity. I know what I'd do with an extra 40 warheads if I couldn't launch them." Ryan unmuted the Russian president.
"President Yermilov, I have a suggestion, but there's no time to waste. I'm listening. Contact your man in Belgrade, Deputy Commander General Severov, and do it now."
Chapter 70. Sarajevo, Bosnia and Herzegovina. Jako sat by himself in the Happy Times bus, his 37 passengers, all bearded Orthodox clergy in simple black cassocks, were inside the stadium, participating in the renewal service, while he remained parked near the facility, waiting for their return. Or so they thought. Thanks to them, entrance into the heart of the sports complex had been arranged, and the parking space next to the stadium pre-assigned by a senior Bosnian prelate. He checked his analog watch again for the 10th time in the last minute. In a few seconds, it would be 10:16. Brkić had been explicit, and his commander's words were sacrosanct. Where were the rockets? They should have arrived by now. They should have exploded. Something was wrong. His orders were clear. Still, he needed clarity. He picked up his cell phone to call Brkić, but the phone was dead. He glanced outside his windshield. He noticed other people struggling with their cell phones. The kuffar must have killed the cell phone signals. No matter. He knew his duty. He pulled the remote control switch out of the storage tray in the console. It was connected wirelessly to the 40 detached thermobaric warheads hidden in the luggage compartment of the bus. Jeko closed his eyes, took a deep breath, and prayed the Shahada. "I testify that there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. Allahu Akbar!" Jeko jammed the remote with his thumb. Nothing. He opened his eyes. What happened? He pressed the button again, and again, and again. Nothing. The batteries must be dead, he decided. Or something else. No matter. Jeko reached for the glove box. Inside was a yellow handle. All he had to do was pull it to manually detonate the charges. He flipped open the glove box just as bullets shattered the bus's giant windshield and tore into his skull and upper torso, killing him instantly. Outside, a knot of Russian and OSA-OBA operatives charged toward the bus. With comms dead,
They flashed hand signals and cleared the way for the demolition experts right behind them. Chapter 71. Sarajevo, Bosnia and Herzegovina. 2 days later, there was a knock at the front door of Ambassador Topal's private residence. He glanced up, puzzled, in his silken robe and pajamas. Who would come calling at this time of night? He shuffled over to the marbled foyer in his dress slippers and opened the door.
Jack, what are you doing here?
You always told me to stop by before I left. Here I am.
It's rather late.
Topal glanced past him, confused. I gave your security team the night off, if that's who you're looking for.
I don't understand, Topal said with a self-effacing smile.
Invite me in, and I'll explain. Topal waved him in.
Please, I'm all ears. Something to drink?
I'm fine, thanks. Topal pointed Jack toward the garish living room with its overstuffed red velvet couches and gold silk chairs. It was a room worthy of a sultan.
Cigarette?
Those things will kill you, Jack said, taking a seat. His face was still scratched and bruised from his brawl with the Chechen. Topal sat on the couch.
First of all, congratulations on stopping Berkic and his plot. You're a hero.
Well, I don't know about that. I was just trying to keep another maniac from murdering thousands in the name of Allah. An unfortunate desire among too many fanatics these days.
Did you know Berkic?
No, not directly. I've heard of the name. It's common enough. Topal leaned forward.
I thought you were already back in the States.
I'm extending my stay a few more days. I have some things I want to clear up before I leave. That's why I'm here.
Obviously, you want to clear up something with me. How can I be of assistance?
Jack slid a cell phone across the ornate rosewood and brass coffee table that separated the two of them. Topal picked it up.
What is this?
That burner phone belonged to Aida. Jack smiled. I pulled it from her corpse.
Aida is dead. How?
I shot her. Topal shifted uncomfortably on his couch. He'd misjudged the young American.
That's quite unfortunate, Jack. I'm sorry to hear it. But what does all of this have to do with me?
We didn't find any burner phones on Berkic, Emir, or anybody else. Just that one, on Aida.
I still don't see the connection to me.
Funny thing about that phone. It's got a voice scrambler and encryption software. Real high-tech. Mil-spec, actually, according to my guy.
So you weren't able to pull anything off of it?
Not yet. But my guy is real good. He'll crack into it eventually. Topal's even smile betrayed his relief.
No offense, Jack, but do you have a point? It is rather late.
Jack nodded at Aida's phone. Judging by that phone, we figured your outfit must have been practicing some serious OPSEC. We're guessing your people were using and tossing these things just about every day. But the problem with OPSEC is that there are a lot of moving parts. Your people did a good job destroying their burner phones. But we decided to dig a little deeper. And you know what we found out? Berkic must have destroyed all of his burner phones, but he kept using the same Iridium Go satellite hotspot for all of his calls. Can you believe it? He must have been a cheap bastard.
You've lost me, Jack.
My guy, his name is Gavin, by the way, and he's really good, did a search. He found a connection between you and Berkic.
A connection? How?
Do you have any idea how many times Berkic used that hotspot to connect calls to a cell tower right next to your embassy and residence?
Topal smiled,
setting Aida's phone back on the table. None whatsoever. Almost as many times as his hotspot connected to cell towers near Aida. All coincidences, I'm sure. There are few cell towers in the area. And as you know, Aida and I had a close relationship, thanks to the Peace and Friendship Center. And I also believe she hired Burkett occasionally as an auto mechanic. So why would they speak on burner phones? I have no idea. Let's not play games. You and Aida were closely connected, and Aida and Burkett were connected. With these cell tower records, we know you and Burkett were connected too. You're talking about statistical probabilities, not actual phone calls. Topal glanced at Aida's phone. You can't prove anything. Not in a court of law. At least, not yet. Jack reached into his pocket, pulled out a spring-loaded bench-made infidel knife, and flicked it open. But I have enough evidence to satisfy my own conscience. So, Ambassador, tell me why you were part of this plot to murder thousands of people, or else I'm going to spill your intestines all over that velvet couch you're sitting on. Topal sat back, swallowing hard. I have diplomatic immunity. Like I give a shit. Jack flashed the blade. Last chance. Truthfully? Yes. I was using Aida and Burkett, but only to disrupt the upcoming unity referendum. How were you using them? I supplied resources to them. Cash, mostly. Especially to Burkett, so he could foment civil strife. You mean civil war? Yes. I suppose that was the goal in Burkett's mind. Now that I think about it, Topal said, extending the lie. But my government would have intervened before things got out of hand. He was behind those terrorist attacks over the last few weeks. The rape of those girls. The wedding massacre. All him. I told him to just agitate, not kill. Topal hoped his lies were convincing. His orders to Burkett had been explicit. But how could Jack know that? And the rocket attack on the Orthodox service? What was your role in that? Topal bolted upright. Nothing whatsoever. That could have caused another world war. The very thing my government is trying to prevent. We're looking to create stability in the region, not crisis. Besides, as you know, I was at the renewal service. Why would I want to kill myself? So the rocket attack was all his idea. Completely. I had no idea that he was planning it. I thought I was using him, but it turns out he was using me. I'm still confused. You just said you were for stability in the region. So why oppose the unity referendum? That would promote peace and stability in Bosnia. Bosnia is a historical miscarriage. These fools can't govern themselves. The local Muslims are secular kuffar, and the Christians are all drunken nihilists, incapable of holding a decent thought. Only Turkey and the new Ottoman Empire can establish lasting peace and stability in this part of the world, as it had in the glorious past. In other words, your plan was to destabilize the region in order to gain control over it. In order to bring a lasting peace, Topal corrected him. He leaned forward. You Americans should thank us. The next war between NATO and Russia will occur in the Balkans. We're your best hope of preventing it. But Turkey is part of NATO. Not for long. NATO is doomed to break apart sooner or later. The European experiment is dying in the icy winds of a demographic winter, even as a generation of Muslim leadership is rising up all over the continent. Who is more naturally suited to lead this new reality than us? Jack shook his head, incredulous. You think this is an episode of Game of Thrones, don't you? These are people's lives you're playing with, you sick son of a bitch. We've been playing this game, as you call it, since the 13th century. Answer me one more question. Are you Red Wing? Topol's owlish face beamed with pride.
Yes.
How did you get that name? Aida's laptop. We cracked it open before her bleach bit was scheduled to run and wipe the disk. Topol sighed.
For want of a nail, eh?
He pulled off his glasses and wiped them with a silk handkerchief, asking,
Have I satisfied your curiosity?
For now, yes. I'm sure the Bosnian government will want to ask you more questions.
I will gladly make myself available.
Jack sat back, smiling. An uncomfortable moment passed. Anything else, Jack? Jack held up a finger, asking Topol to wait. He touched the Bluetooth in his ear. Gavin?
Yeah.
Now?
Good.
I'll tell him. Jack rang off.
You like social media, don't you?
It has its uses,
Topol said. Jack stood. You might want to check your Twitter feed and any other platform you like.
Why would I do that?
Try it. Topol reached into his pocket and pulled out his smartphone. He opened up his Twitter account. He frowned, then glanced up at Jack, frightened.
Play it.
Topol tapped a button. His own voice played over the speaker, then Jack's.
Truthfully? Yes. I was using Aida and Birkic, but only to disrupt the upcoming unity referendum. I supplied resources to foment civil strife.
You mean civil war?
Yes. I suppose that was the goal.
But my government would have intervened before things got out of hand.
Topol's face turned ashen.
How?
My man Gavin.
Did I tell you how good he was?
Topol leaned back in the couch cushions, utterly distraught. Jack snatched up Aida's phone from the table as he headed for the door. He turned, grinning.
Better watch your six.
Chapter 72. Jack and Kolak stood in a small city park not far from OSA-OBA headquarters. They were both silent, staring down at a small, weathered headstone marked Aida Kuric, 1989-1993. It was one of hundreds in the park, though not nearly as noticeable as most, and perhaps the most pitiful.
Here is your mother, Aida,
Kolak said.
I don't understand.
The woman you knew as Aida Kuric was actually named Sabina Kvirtsic. She was the only child of Samir Kvirtsic, the local head of the Bosniak Mafia. Aida's family ran a profitable and well-respected tour company before the war. Kvirtsic was high on the Interpol wanted list at the time. He saw his opportunity to steal the business and change identities when the war broke out. Aida was killed during the war after her eye surgery, and the rest of her family was murdered by Kvirtsic. The Kvirtsic family assumed the Kuric family's identities, including Sabina, who took Aida's. When Samir Kvirtsic died of cancer, his only child, Sabina Kvirtsic, took over. The Aida I know didn't strike me as a jihadi radical. She wasn't. She was a criminal, pure and simple. She used the tour company to run drugs, guns, and illegals all over the region for years. Topol and Birkic were just her most recent customers. She was making millions serving both of them. It was brilliant. But she knew about the plan to start the war between NATO and Russia. Why would she do that?
Kolak shrugged.
Scarcity is profitable. Mafias thrive in wartime.
And still no sign of Birkic?
None. He's probably out of the country by now, but we've issued an Interpol red notice. That should turn up something eventually.
Jack pulled out his smartphone and took a picture of the grave for his mother.
I never did thank you for taking out the garbage for me.
Kolak shrugged.
It was a small thing. The dead assassin had been incinerated along with the rest of the trash in the dumpster. Anything else I can do for you, Jack? You can thank Lydia again for saving my bacon. I was sure we were going to crash. She is my best helicopter pilot. I will pass your commendation along to her. And I've been meaning to ask you. How do you know that Aida and I had been stopped by the Russians? Were you following us? Kolak lifted Jack's wrist and tapped his eye watch. The same way I found you at the launch site. When I first interviewed you, I had my people put a software bug in here, forcing it to broadcast your GPS position to me at all times, even though your watch indicated it wasn't doing so. Jack fingered his eye watch. Guess I'm going back to analog. Do you have any plans before heading back home? Jack nodded at Midas, Dom, and Adara, recently arrived from Croatia, where their Gulfstream had been diverted after the airport attack. I'm taking them to experience their first plate of cevapi. Care to join? Kolak flashed his crooked smile. Most definitely. Chapter 73. The Turkish embassy was a modern but modest four-story building on the leafy Vilsonovo-Ushetliste, a wide boulevard only recently converted to a pedestrian promenade. No cars or motorcycles allowed. While normal citizens of the city were forbidden to drive motor vehicles on the tree-lined street, the Turkish embassy was allowed an occasional car on an as-needed basis, and today was one of those occasions. An armored Audi Q7 SUV pulled up to the curb in front of the white concrete, wood, and glass building. A two-story tall Turkish flag, red with the white crescent moon and star, hung on the face of the building. It blocked some or all of the views of several street-facing offices. Topal's office, of course, was on the top floor, enjoying an unobstructed panorama of the promenade and the park across the street. Moments after the Audi SUV pulled up, a Turkish security detail emerged, clearing a path to the vehicle. On an agent's signal, another security detail exited the embassy, surrounding the hunched figure of Ambassador Topal, wearing a Kevlar vest. The Bosnian government had kept its promise to keep all traffic and protesters from the promenade and away from the Turkish embassy today. But the ambassador's security team wasn't taking any chances. The social media firestorm kicked up by Gavin's edited tape of Topal confessing his crimes went viral, organically, on Balkan social media within hours. Topal was the most hated man in Bosnia at the moment, since Brkić couldn't be found. Under a constant barrage of death threats, Topal's security team wasn't taking any chances on his short trip to the airport. He'd been called back to Ankara for immediate consultations with the foreign ministry after the recent social media revelations. Topal was related to the president, so he wasn't in fear for his life. But certainly his future in government service was in doubt. His diplomatic security team ushered him swiftly into the waiting SUV. The team lead rode shotgun, while a grim senior officer from MIT, Turkish National Intelligence, sat in back next to Topal. The driver punched the gas, and the Audi rocketed forward. 3 minutes into the 16-minute drive, three bicyclists pedaling furiously along the promenade dashed out into the street, three abreast. The driver slammed his horn and his brakes, burning rubber and slowing to a violent stop to avoid killing the idiots. The bikers immediately scattered. The Audi's stop was just long enough. Ibrahim, Mr. Clean, had a clear line of sight from the third-story apartment overlooking the quiet street. He pulled the trigger on the RPG-7. The heavily armored Audi was no match for the tank-busting heat warhead. The vehicle erupted in a cloud of shrapnel and fire. Topal died instantly. Not so the others. Chapter 74. Slavkov Forest, Eastern Czech Republic. The old man's eyes opened slowly, awakened by the cold steel of a pistol barrel pressed in his ear. "Nice place you got here," John Clark said, admiring the trophy heads and antlers on the walls. "Real rustic. Not all fancy, like some gilded Malaysian whorehouse." Clark sat in a well-worn leather chair next to the Czech's large but simple bed. His hunting lodge on the wood-studded country estate had been built according to traditional methods, using local materials. "Thank you, Mr. Clark."
"You know my name."
"Impressive.
I know everybody in your line of work."
Clark leaned back in his chair. The old man had been hell on wheels in his youth, according to the few files Gavin had been able to dig up on him. But now the senior crime lieutenant was past his physical prime. So was he, Clark reminded himself. But even in his eighth decade, the ex-SEAL was still in better shape than this mook had ever been.
"If you know me, then you know I don't fuck around."
"Indeed I do. May I sit up?"
"Sure. But keep your hands where I can see them."
"Of course."
The Czech leveraged his long frame up against the pillows and the headboard.
"I can't see without my glasses. May I retrieve them from my nightstand?"
"We're not here to watch home movies, Chief."
"Then to what do I owe the pleasure of meeting the famous John Clark?"
"We have a little problem we need to sort out."
"And that would be?"
"Your organization has put out a hit on a good friend of mine, a fellow by the name of Jack Ryan, Jr. Sound familiar?"
"Too familiar."
"You don't sound happy about it."
"I'm not. The hit should never have been initiated."
"Good. Then there won't be a problem calling it off."
"I'm afraid there is."
John leaned forward, his cold-blooded scowl turning even more so, though the half-blind Czech couldn't see it.
"Why?"
"I didn't place the order. Vladimir Vasilev did. He's in charge of the organization, in case you weren't aware."
"He's in some hospital in Paris, dying. We were under the impression you were in charge."
"I'm the chief operating officer, yes, but he remains the CEO, and his last dying wish is that Jack Ryan Jr. should die before he does. I opposed the hit from the beginning, but, alas, I couldn't prevent it, and I couldn't stop it, owing to certain organizational dynamics."
"Organizational dynamics? Be more specific."
"If Vasilev were dead and I were in charge, I would call off the hit in a heartbeat. I would even go so far as to kill Vasilev myself in order to take charge and end the hit. But if Vasilev dies of anything other than natural causes, my life is forfeit. But, more to the point, if you kill me now, the next person in line after me would be responsible for carrying out Vasilev's order, and his life would be forfeit as well, all the way down the line, until Jack Jr. is dead."
"A dead man's switch," John said.
"That's a problem. But I have a funny feeling you might have a solution." "Indeed I do. But it won't be easy."
"Don't need easy. But it better damn well be good, or you'll wake up tomorrow with your brains blown out all over that feather pillow, and a suicide note pinned to your pajamas." "Those are my organizational dynamics."
Chapter 75. Stockholm. Göran Fasla trudged through the snow crunching beneath his boots, cursing the bitter cold of a record early storm. His gloved hands were shoved into the pockets of his worn-out down jacket, a gift from an aid agency. In fact, everything the Macedonian immigrant wore this evening had come from a Swedish refugee organization, which collected used clothing from the generous souls in the city. The fools.
Fazla had just left a clandestine meeting in a public housing complex in Rinkeby, one of the famous no-go zones in Stockholm, where police feared to appear at all, let alone intervene, despite the government's denials to the contrary. He'd been walking for blocks, replaying in his mind the conversations he'd had with the others. It had gone very well. The majority of residents in this part of town were foreign-born, as were so many other people in Sweden these days. The Liberal government's generous open-door refugee policy had been particularly welcoming to persecuted Muslims like Fazla. Fazla wasn't his real name, of course. For the past 23 years, he'd been known by another, Tarik Brkić. But, of course, that wasn't his birth name either. Brkić used forged documents supplied months earlier by Aida's Peace and Friendship Center to gain refugee status and to climb to the top of Sweden's immigration list. The center had also provided his credentials certifying him as a victim of persecution, with no criminal record or terrorist affiliations. It even listed him as a skilled auto mechanic, which was actually true. This provided him immediate employment at a Volvo dealership in a refugee transition program in one of Stockholm's affluent suburbs. Brkić blended in nicely at work with his shaved head, shaved beard, mustache, and Western clothing, including a pair of cheap H&M sunglasses he wore to hide his distinctively blind eye. And when he couldn't wear his sunglasses? Well, it was evidence of the persecution he had suffered in life, wasn't it? But Brkić hadn't picked Sweden because it would be easy for him to enter into it or to blend in with the locals. Sweden was a hunting ground for him now. A perfect one, really. It was another Yugoslavia in the making, with hundreds of thousands of Muslim Iranians, Iraqis, Syrians, Turks, Kurds, Somalis, Eritreans, and even Bosnians living in the Nordic country. Arabic was already the second mother tongue of Sweden, surpassing Finnish. Brkić merely shrugged when he heard the BBC News report that the unity referendum had passed with a startling majority. He no longer cared. He was on a new mission now, and soon his wife and children would join him. In the few short weeks he'd been there, Brkić had already successfully recruited 7 members into his new organization, the Islamic Front in Sweden. And tonight's meeting with the Iraqi brothers would likely result in at least 2 more. But now it was late, and he was tired and cold, and it was still a long, miserable slog through the snow-covered streets to the nearest bus stop. "Hey, you! White man!" a voice called in Swedish from out of the alley. "Got a cigarette?" Brkić didn't speak Swedish. He had signed up for language classes only last week, since most white Swedes spoke English anyway. Despite the language barrier, the menacing tone of the man's voice was obvious. Brkić trudged on, hoping that the glowing street lamp up ahead provided enough light to deter the man who called to him. Over the crunch of his own boots, he heard the muffled rush of several feet speeding up behind him. Brkić whipped around. 11 lean, dark, angular faces confronted him. Somalis, Brkić guessed. Teenagers, mostly, glaring at him. A few flashed white teeth, like smiling wolves. The tallest one of the group approached, his thin skull wrapped beneath an olive-drab Swedish army winter cap, its flaps tied down around his ears and secured in a bow beneath the triangle of his chin. Thick flakes of wet snow began to fall, collecting on the brim. "You don't belong here, white man. This is our territory. Pay the tax." Brkić shrugged, feigning ignorance and fear. But his sharp eyes were sizing up the order of attack he had to make if he hoped to survive this engagement, starting with the leader first. The leader stepped closer, his smile widening, gloved palms open to the sky in a gesture of peace. "Just a little money, huh?" One of the Somalis standing to his left howled with laughter as another barked like a madman, leaping around in the snow. Brkić turned,
More Somali voices called out from the upper stories of the buildings around him, shouting and mocking. Burkic glanced behind him. Another group of young men had approached him, equally menacing. A heavy object, hard and angular, struck him in the skull, blunted by his thick woolen cap. Burkic reached up to touch his wound, his vision blurring. He turned around.